All right, welcome everybody to the Peter Schiff Show. I'm Tom Woods in for Peter Schiff on this October 13th, 2011. We've got a great program for you today because later in this hour, we're going to be joined by Judge Andrew Napolitano, great hero of many listeners of this program, senior judicial analyst at Fox News. Don't hold that against him. He's going to be with us talking about his new book, It Is Dangerous to Be Right When the Government Is Wrong. Then in the second hour, we've got another great guest. Bradley Thompson has a book called from last year called Neoconservatism, An Obituary for an Idea. So this is going to be one hot couple of hours, so stay tuned with me. Let's get rolling. I am watching a lot of polls lately. It's very interesting to watch what's been going on in the Republican field. It's like there's a flavor of the week who's way, way up, and then that flavor is out, and it's Romney at the top again. And there's another flavor of the week, and then that one's out, and still Romney. So for Romney, has you got to hand it to him. As plastic as the guy is, he has staying power. And it's one of these guys like nobody really wants, like even his own supporters, you know, can't be bothered to click on an online poll for the guy. But there he is, though, standing there in the background, grinning at you, like, hey, look, I'm still standing here. You know, make fun of me all you want, but here I am standing here. But it seems like lately it's been quite astonishing to watch the rise of Herman Cain, who, when he announced, however many months ago, that he was running, he was pretty much laughed at and dismissed. Who is this guy? You know, media doesn't really know him, so how could he possibly count? And then all of a sudden he surprises everybody. Low in the polls, and then suddenly has this incredible surge after winning the straw poll in Florida. And I've been talking to people, what is the attraction to Herman Cain? Like, why are you guys supporting him? I've been asking this on my blog. I'm not trying to be snarky. I genuinely want to know, what's the attraction? And people say, look, he's well-spoken. He seems like he's a tough cookie. He's been in the private sector. And he debates well. He comes across well when he's talking. But what are the specific plans that you like? And I very rarely do I get specific. Some people do like his tax proposal, which I think is at least debatable. But I hear things like, you know, he's a businessman, so he can run government like a business, and that's just what we need. And that's what the Romney people say, right? Mitt Romney's been in the private sector, so he can run government better than these jerks who've been running it all this time. And I understand there's a superficial plausibility to that. And so I want to get back to that in a minute about running government like a business. But I want to start off dealing with the biggest weakness that I see that Herman Cain has. And it's not just that he was with the Federal Reserve of Kansas City or things of that nature, which are problematic. His defense of Alan Greenspan the other night was pretty creepy. I mean, like clearly the worst Fed chairman ever. And he was saying, well, you know, at least early on he was pretty good. And he wasn't actually willing to say, but later he made mistakes. He was more or less saying, well, you know, people have said that he made mistakes later. So that's a problem. That's a bit of a problem. And for the Tea Party people to support that, to me, indicates that they just haven't been screwed enough by this system. They have not been exploited enough by the current regime for it to hit them that they should be against Greenspan. Like, the Greenspan has caused them endless pain. If they don't see this yet, then we have tremendous educational work very much still ahead of us. But his big problem is this. Here we are on the Peter Schiff Show here. Now, one of Peter's claims to fame is that he called the collapse, right? I mean, just to a T. I mean, Fannie and Freddie collapsing, all this sorts of stuff. I mean, he just saw it, and he said it to the mortgage bankers in 2006, I think, in a speech you can watch on YouTube. I mean, he goes into these hostile audiences and tells them the opposite of what they want to hear, which is admirable, right? I mean, how many politicians are going to do that? You know, say the opposite of what you want to hear. But Cain, I think, is the anti-Schiff. He's the anti-Schiff because September 1st, 2008, he gives the economy a clean bill of health. I talk about this on my own site and some of the writing I've been doing on Cain. He gives the economy a clean bill of health September 1st, 2008. You know what happened September 7th, 2008? Fannie and Freddie were taken over by the U.S. government. You know what else happened in 2008? Lehman Brothers collapsed. AIG was bailed out. We were told by Hank Paulson that the economy is so bad that we need a $700 billion TARP package just to keep the lights on. We won't even have an economy without this money, is what Ben Bernanke said. So how did we go from being so good on September 1st that Kane can't think of a word to say about it to being so bad that the bottom's going to fall out of the whole thing if we don't get $700 billion pronto handed to the banks? Well, of course, the answer is things weren't so good on September 1st, 2008. But that's his big problem. And I said I made a video on my YouTube channel, Tom Woods TV, the other day saying this is Ron Paul's question. This is his question for Hank Kane in the debates. Ron Paul can say, in 2001, I said precisely that we had just gone through a boom and bust with internet stocks and that now the Federal Reserve was substituting a real estate bubble for the internet, the tech stock bubble, and that this bubble too would burst as they all do. Well, that was 7 years in advance. Herman Cain, 7 days in advance. You're not seeing this coming. You don't think that's a problem that Americans should be concerned about? You don't find this a source of embarrassment? You know, that would be the headline. That would be the news right there. Ron Paul says that. So I throw that out there for the consideration of anybody who might be listening. I know it's not Ron Paul style to call people out. But you know what? Sometimes you got to adapt your style when the circumstances demand it. And I would say the dire situation that we are in demands it. Well, we've got a great program, as I say. We've got Judge Napolitano coming up later this hour. We're going to be talking about neoconservatism, which is a term you hear all the time, right? You know, I mean, what is this term? Who are the neocons? What are they up to? What do they want? Are they going to just keep on succeeding and being part of every presidential administration from now till the end of time? These are all good questions that we are going to be entertaining. On the other side of this break, I'm going to take on this, can you run government like a business? And I'll be taking your calls as well. Don't forget, 855-4-SHIFT. That's 855-472-4433. Make your voice heard. Let's get this conversation going here on this Thursday on The Peter Schiff Show, the gold standard in talk radio.
The Peter Schiff Show. To President Obama, Secretary Geithner, Madam Pelosi, and all of the socialist econ professors across America.
We're sorry.
We're sorry. Peter Schiff is back on the air.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Peter Schiff Show. I'm Tom Woods, in for Peter. I want to just continue up what I was saying, and then we'll head over to the phones. I want to just talk about this misconception that if only we can get a businessman in government, that'll fix things, right? Because businessmen roll up their sleeves and they'll run government like a business. Well, this wasn't going to work for Ross Perot. It's not going to work for Mitt Romney or Herman Cain. Government and business are entirely different things. Because how does a business succeed, right? How does an entrepreneur succeed? You succeed by making profits, by making sure that what's coming in terms of sales revenues more than compensates you for the costs that you've incurred, for your inputs. And it's got to more than compensate you to a particular degree so that you get a reasonable rate of return. So it wouldn't have been better for you to just park your money in the bank and save yourself the trouble. Well, how do you figure out if you're doing well or not in business? Well, you calculate it through profits. You have a profit and loss signal. That's how the market tells you, are you wasting resources or are you adding value? That's how you know. That's the only way you can know. Am I doing the right thing? Am I locating my physical plant in the place that's most economical, that conserves resources the most for society? Am I using the most efficient input process? Am I using the best materials in terms of a cost? Do I have too many people in my call center? Do I have too many people in customer service? Do I have too few people in customer service? This is not an arbitrary thing. Profit and loss signals give you the answer to that question. Government doesn't get those signals because it's not selling a product. we have to take it. They're going to take our money no matter what. They're going to take it from us no matter what and give us whatever service it wants to give us. So it has no profit and loss mechanism because there's no voluntary action on the part of the consumer. The stuff is simply taken away. So there's no way they can know whether they should be doing X or Y. There's no, they're completely groping in the dark. How do they know whether there should be more police or fewer police or more of this service or less of that service or more judges or fewer judges or more courtrooms or fewer they're always, of course, groping in the dark. They have no feedback mechanism. So they can't know how resources should be allocated. It's exactly the same reason that Ludwig von Mises said socialism can't work, because profit and loss calculation is foreclosed by the nature of the system. So the state is always groping in the dark. All right, I'm going to go to the phones now. I've got Ed in Florida. Ed, you're on the Peter Schiff Show. Welcome.
Good morning, Tom. It's a thrill to speak to you. You are one of my heroes.
Thank you.
I love that lecture you did out in L.A. That was just the most inspirational thing I've ever seen.
Oh, you're very kind to me. Thank you.
And, you have the judge coming on, and, I hate to use the word draft, but if Ron Paul would select the judge to be his running mate, I think it would be a slam dunk. Now, I feel that you would be a great vice president, and Peter, Bob Murphy, Stefan Molyneux is not an American citizen, but you know what I mean? You guys have just completely blown my mind. And, what are your feelings? You know, like I said, the word draft is an ugly word. The judge is obviously free to do what he wants. But unfortunately, you guys don't really have the high profile, and it's horrible,
yeah, right,
to
right.
say that.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. Oh, yeah, let's talk about this, about running. I mean, it's in some ways premature, but it's kind of like, doing like a baseball dream team. Like, what could it hurt to sit around and think about it? I've joked with the judge about this myself, and maybe we'll talk to him a little bit about this, and I suspect he'll be sort of cagey about it the way anybody would be, but I've joked about it, saying that, I can't wait to be helping you out in 2016, and he doesn't say there's absolutely zero chance of it whatsoever, and so when somebody says that, I feel like, all right, well, I'll keep badgering that person gently, and when the opportunity arises.
Yes, but please do. And by the way, I'm smelling cabinet position, Tom.
I would never get past the Senate, but I appreciate that. I would never get past it. Only if martial law had been declared and all Senate confirmations were suspended would I have any chance, but I do appreciate that. But just talking about when you choose a running mate, I mean, the usual political calculation that you have to make is, what does this person bring to the ticket that I don't have already? I mean, that's the way that – If Ron Paul were to get the GOP nomination, the party machine is going to be thinking, well, what does he not have? Well, he's got to appeal to our base. And there is, to some degree, a disconnect between Ron Paul and the base. I think that's there's no reason for that. There are ways to explain and defend all of his policies in ways that can appeal to conservative Republicans. And that's what he does in his book, The Revolution, A Manifesto, is basically to say, explain, here's what I'm saying. And I'm just saying what a lot of people on the political right have said over the years. I'm not saying anything that's particularly crazy. It's only crazy in the current situation where the mainstream runs from Joe Biden to Mitt Romney. Yeah, well, if that's the mainstream, then by definition, we're all crazy. But that shouldn't be the mainstream.
No, so it's a lunatic asylum.
No, it totally is. The inmates are running it. But my point is that they might say, well, the judge appeals to this libertarian base that Ron Paul already has. But my answer to that would be the judge is very, very good at – I've seen him do this. He'll go to a Glenn Beck event, and he'll go out there, and everybody loves the judge, right? I mean, he's a tough, big Italian, libertarian conservative type. How can you not love this guy, right? And outspoken and loud and in your face and doesn't apologize for where he stands. People love this guy. But the great thing about him is he can talk to a crowd like that. He can speak their language. And they go away saying, that guy, he's my friend. And he's one of us. So that then when he turns around and says, now listen, I'm not some crazy out there. I'm not some left wing anything. But I'm going to tell you right now, there's a problem with the Patriot Act. Let me tell you what it is. They listen to him because they say, I trust this guy. You know, I can rely on what he's telling me. That is a great skill. So I think he has that ability because I think he is a skilled debater. He wouldn't take anything from anybody. He would be a bulldog. He would really compliment Ron Paul's personality. And at the same time, the ticket would be plausible. Ron Paul slash Mitt Romney is not plausible. It would be Romney would indeed bring you the Eastern establishment. That's true. But the ticket is not coherent. So I love the idea of the judge. And I mean, what's Fox News going to do then? What are they going to black out Ron Paul when their own guy is on the ticket? I mean, then that would be a fun thing to watch. Ed, thanks so much for the call. Much appreciated. Make sure and join in the conversation, everybody. 855-4-SHIFT. That's 855-472-4433. We've got just a couple minutes before our break at the end of the first half of this hour. Break coming up at the bottom of the hour. But I just want to just say a little something about the judge here, because I want to not spend so much time introducing him so that we can spend all his limited time just chatting up a storm here. I want to first of all tell you guys that you ought to be watching his program on the Fox Business Network. And I'm still surprised at how many freedom lovers out there who are 100% out there for the cause who don't know about the judge's program. It's unbelievable. We all have to tune in, because the better the ratings are, the greater the prospects for the judge in the future. Freedom Watch is airing at 8 p.m. and 11 p.m. Eastern Time, Monday through Friday, on the Fox Business Network. Now, you may have to request that from your cable company, but go ahead and do that, because this is a show where the judge will have guests on that nobody else is going to have on. He's going to talk about topics that no one else is going to talk about, and he's going to hit a lot of those people who are tuning in expecting to see a standard Fox News program, and instead they are going to get a dose of liberty, the likes of which that they did not see coming. So he is so much to be supported. And we got to get out there and support this guy. This is a guy who has supported so many of us, taking people, for example, like me. And Peter Schiff is very well known. I'm not as well known as Peter is, of course. But he'll have me on his program, and we are able to get issues out there and personalities out there the rest of the media won't even touch. He has done so much for this movement. Let's do something for him. Let's tune into that Freedom Watch. And let's get his book, It Is Dangerous to Be Right When the Government Is Wrong. We'll be talking to him about that on the other side of this break. So stay tuned on the Peter Schiff Show, the gold standard in talk radio.
The Peter Schiff Show. Now return to the Peter Schiff Show. Call in now, 855-4-SCHIFF. That's 855-472-4433. The Peter Schiff Show.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Peter Schiff Show. I'm Tom Woods, in for Peter. About to talk to Judge Andrew Napolitano of Fox News, the senior judicial analyst there. There's just been breaking news over at Fox, so the judge is over giving his commentary, doing the Lord's work, so to speak. So we're going to give him a little break, a little time to get over here. So in the meantime, I get to tell you a little something about what I've been reading this weekend, which is the judge's book. So he gets from Voltaire, It Is Dangerous to Be Right When the Government Is Wrong, and his subtitle is The Case for Personal Freedom. And what we've got here really is a primer on all kinds of topics you can think of, starting with the Declaration of Independence, and then you get a chapter on the right to own property, so property rights, freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom to travel, the right to privacy, you own your own body, the right to self-defense, and then the right to enjoy peace, the right to sound money, to spend your own money, and even at the end, the right to ignore the state. Whoa. So this is some serious stuff we got coming out here from the judge. I'm going to ask him some tricky little questions here about this, because now the tables are turned. I get to talk to the judge and ask him what I want to know from him. But it's true that in looking through this, I find repeatedly that the judge is willing to take on the sorts of things that you would be skewered alive for trying to do if you took them on in a political campaign. But the judge is the sort of guy who he will stick by what he's saying, regardless of the pressure that's put on him. And it's interesting to note that when you look at what sorts of things the judge says about civil liberties, personal liberties, the drug war, the Patriot Act, these aren't just things that he has been saying over the past few years because he's grown disillusioned with Obama or the Bush administration. He's been saying these things through his whole career. Like, you can see this for year after year after year. This is a guy who is completely consistent, and we're very, very grateful to have him. While we're waiting for the judge to come on, I'm going to take one quick call, and then we'll get an update on where he is. So let me jump over to Dave in New Jersey. Dave, welcome to the Peter Schiff Show. Okay, we ain't got no Dave, but we do have an Alex. Alex in Brooklyn. Oh, hold on, Alex. Continue to be patient, because I'm just told that we do indeed have the judge on the line. I don't know how this guy does this, running around like a chicken with his head cut off, doing a million things every day. It's extremely generous of him to spend some time with us. Judge Andrew Napolitano, senior judicial analyst at Fox News, who was an adjunct professor for 11 years at Seton Hall Law School, who had quite an interesting tenure as a judge in all different areas of the law, and he is so generous to spend some time with us this morning. Judge, thanks so much for being on the Peter Schiff Show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on the Peter Schiff Show with Tom Woods.
Thank you so much, Judge. And I was just saying before you came on, the tables are turned. Look who's interviewing whom now. Well,
you
I'm so
anything you want, my friend.
Well, I'm so thrilled to be able to talk to you and have a chance to see an advanced copy of your book. But let's start off just saying a little something about Freedom Watch, your program. I was plugging it before you came on because I want to make sure every freedom lover needs to know about this show. We can't take for granted that everybody is plugged in and knows about Freedom Watch. Just give us a quick overview. What's the show about? How's it doing? And what kind of a gap is it filling?
Well, it fills the gap of a that is needed for watching the government. I mean, I refer to myself somewhat tongue-in-cheek as the night watchman. I watch the government as it steals your liberty and steals your property, and we do this for an hour a day, 5 p.m. Or excuse me, 8 p.m. We tape at 5. 8 p.m. Eastern, and it's repeated at 11 p.m. Eastern on the Fox Business Network. And we unabashedly challenge government in almost everything it does. It's in a typical Fox interview style and sometimes debates, and always we have a panel where we have a strong libertarian, a sort of middle of the road but big government person, and then a progressive slash liberal debating what the issues may be. We address everything from foreign affairs to the Constitution to civil liberties to economics to where do progressives and libertarians agree to what is the proper role of the federal government in our lives today, what is the proper role of government in our lives today. And you know me, Tom, I'm not afraid to say what I think and not afraid to provide the troops with the intellectual ammunition that they need to challenge those in government.
Well, I think both of those things are fantastic, because it does give people arguments that they can use with their friends when they're badgered all the time. Why don't you support the jobs program or whatever? But also, and I'm not just saying this to flatter you, you know, we already got you for the interview, so I don't need to do that. Your example is very important for people to see somebody in your position who knows that, you know, he might hurt his own ratings by saying something very unpopular at a time when 80% of the country feels one way, and maybe 80 or 90% of Fox News viewers feel one way. The judge will stand up there fearlessly and say the opposite. That's a great example to a lot of us who sometimes feel beaten down by the establishment. There's a temptation to just cave in and give up, and you don't do it night after night after night. That's a great example to all of us.
Very kind to say that. I do my best to stay true to first principles, and at the end of each of the shows, I give what we call a rant. It's like a closing argument. It's maybe between 3.5 and 4 minutes long, and I try to draw on first principles in those arguments. That government is best which governs least. The people are entitled to a government that stays within the confines of the Constitution. The Constitution was written to keep the government off the people's backs. Now, sometimes that means saying things that are unpopular, like the president had no authority to assassinate Osama bin Laden. He would have had authority to have arrested him and had him extradited here for trial. But if the guy doesn't have a gun in his hands and he's not shooting at American troops, there's no authority to kill him. The same goes for Anwar Awlaki. If the government has a case against him, present the case. But for the president to become judge, jury, and executioner is not authorized by the Constitution. Now, when you make that argument, Tom, you go against the popular will that perceives these people as the demons that they probably were and rejoices in their demise. But in the act of rejoicing over their demise, they overlook the mechanism of their demise, which, if gone unchecked, would let the president become a king. This is the same president who started his own war in Libya while the Congress sat there like a potted plant. Why? Because everybody hated Muammar Gaddafi, even though George Bush and Tony Blair embraced him as a warrior in the war on terror. Suddenly he became a demon, and so it was okay to drop bombs and kill innocents in order to chase him from power. When you make those arguments, you sometimes run against the grain of well-intended people who are happy when bad guys are dispatched from the scene. But my job is to pay careful attention to procedure. Justice Felix Frankfurter, an FDR appointee, but occasionally faithful to the Constitution, once said, "The history of human freedom is paying careful attention to procedure, not what is the government's end result, but how did the government get there?"
Right.
That's
right.
What we do on Freedom Watch.
Well, that's absolutely fantastic. I want to shift. I want to talk about your book, It is Dangerous to Be Right When the Government is Wrong. I suspect the official release date is next Tuesday, but it's already available on Amazon, so I felt it was okay to go ahead and have you on and talk about it. And one of the topics that you cover in here is a familiar one. I mean, you cover in here so many topics giving the pro-freedom position. I mean, I just lost count of them. But I do want to talk a little bit about an old favorite, because I think it's a useful segue from what we were just talking about, and that's the Patriot Act, because this is one of these cases where I think there are people who, just without maybe knowing the details of the Patriot Act, just think, well, look, we have bad people who are, we believe, plotting nefarious plots against us, and, well, you know, if somebody has to look into my library records in order to prevent that from happening, then that's okay with me. I mean, that's going to keep us. How else are we going to be kept safe without doing a little bit of snooping around? Like, what do you say to that?
Well, I argue that the snooping around doesn't keep us safe, and even if it did, we pay a greater price in the loss of privacy and the loss of freedom. Look, the Fourth Amendment, which basically says if the government wants information from you or about you, it has to go to a judge and present evidence of probable cause, meaning more likely than not that you committed a crime, is the quintessentially American amendment among the Bill of Rights, because it stands for the right to be left alone. And that means self-dignity. That means that the poorest person's cottage cannot have the government cross the threshold into it without the consent of the person or without a neutral judge authorizing it. The Patriot Act actually permits federal agents to do what we fought a revolution against Great Britain because of what it permitted its agents to do. The king permitted federal agents to write their own search warrants. They were granted general permission to go anywhere, but they authorized themselves to go into a colonist's home and look for and seize whatever they wanted. 225 years later, we find legislation enacted by the Congress that authorizes federal agents to bypass the Constitution and write their own search warrants. And when they hand you the search warrant, they say to you, you can't tell anybody about this. You can't tell your spouse. You can't tell your priest in confessional. You can't tell a lawyer in her or his office. You can't even answer truthfully in a public courtroom whether or not you received one of these self-written search warrants. Otherwise, we'll prosecute you for telling anyone that we came visiting. So not only is the Fourth Amendment violated, but the First Amendment is violated. If we don't stick to first principles, if we let the government scare us into thinking it's keeping us safe because it's violating our rights, well, then we don't respect natural law, we don't respect individual rights, and we have a princedom or a kingdom rather than a popularly elected republic that establishes and stands for first principles. Look at this nonsense that Eric Holder revealed 2 days ago. The FBI has uncovered 17 plots to attack us since 9/11. all 17 of them was created, monitored, controlled, and caused by the FBI. So it is attempting to say that it saved us from a danger that it created and therefore never actually existed. If we allow the government to do that, to violate rights in order to make these claims, we won't be safe and we won't be free.
Well, I don't think anyone could have said it better than that. And I agree. It's very interesting about it. The government bats 1,000 on threats it itself creates. Well, who wouldn't? On the other side of the break, Judge, I want to ask you, well, I don't want to give it away. We're going to have some fun on the other side of the break. But the book is It Is Dangerous to Be Right When the Government is Wrong. My guest, Judge Andrew Napolitano. Make sure and stay tuned to the Peter Schiff Show for another segment with the judge and for an hour on the neocons. Coming up here on the Peter Schiff Show, the gold standard in talk radio.
The Peter Schiff Show. Since the Peter Schiff Show was last on the air, the national debt added another $7.89 million. Luckily, Peter's intelligence is growing twice as fast.
That's incredible.
Welcome back to your source of sanity in an insane world. It's the Peter Schiff Show.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Peter Schiff Show. I'm Tom Woods, in for Peter. Joined for one more segment by Judge Andrew Napolitano, great hero to us all. Judge, before I get back to your book, which, again, I love this book. It's a great primer on liberty and all its ramifications. It's amazing to me that in the midst of 14-hour days at Fox, you have time to be basically writing a book a year. I don't see how you do it, but that's your own secret. We have a seminar on that. But I want to ask you something that basically people have been pleading with me to ask. I think you know what it is. But there's been a lot of talk about Judge Andrew Napolitano running for some kind of political office just because you are a take-no-prisoners, tough as nails, super smart guy. You'd have tremendous support. You're, I would say, almost the only person outside of Ron Paul that the whole Ron Paul community unanimously trusts. Like, there are people in the Ron Paul orbit, you know, 80% of us like, or 70%, 100% like Judge Napolitano. Is there any chance you would even consider that, or is it definitively ruled out now and forever?
Oh, you're so kind. I'm not even sure you're talking about me, but I'll take all the flattery and praise that I can get. Look, I believe in the liberty movement, and I see the need for a night watchman, and the megaphone and the audience that I have now as the night watchman for the liberty movement is extraordinary, and it's a gift to me. You know, I don't own Fox. I'm just employed here. And as long as they want to give me this platform, I think I'm going to stay here, because my opportunity is really to educate people about the subtle and insidious ways in which liberty can be lost. And I think I can do far more good in that process of education with the platform that I have now than with any other platform. On the other hand, were Congressman Paul to be elected president of the United States, and if there is a vacancy on the Supreme Court of the United States during his term, I'd be all ears.
Well, that is very good to know.
To suggest I'm even qualified for that, but that's something you can't turn down.
No. You would have to have your head examined. Well, I mean, people talk about you. I just had a call before you came on, somebody saying, look, the judge would be a great VP. And,
well,
I mean,
I'm aware of that.
Yeah.
I'm aware of those very flattering websites out there, and I'm aware of the polls that they have taken. That's good for the ego. It's also good for spreading our message. I know that sometimes my voice and my unique style can be the messenger, not the message. So to that extent, it's helpful, but it's probably unrealistic.
Now, it's only fair you have an author on. You got to talk about his book. So getting back to the book, everybody, once again, is It Is Dangerous to Be Right When the Government is Wrong, The Case for Personal Freedom. Before you came on, I was just going through some of the chapter titles, all the different areas that you cover here. What do you find is the toughest sell that people are most skeptical when you try to make the case for freedom? What's the hardest one?
That the government can't take freedom away from us. Only the staunch libertarians recognize natural rights, that is, rights that are integral to our humanity, even well-educated people, some of whom are running for president, not Ron Paul, slip into the idea that freedom of speech comes from the government. It doesn't come from the government. The government has an affirmative obligation to protect it. But probably the right that people are most willing to give up, and this is very unsettling, is the right to be left alone, the right to privacy. And when I argue things like, well, the government can't track your cell phone and track you without a search warrant, they basically say to me, as you did earlier when you were playing devil's advocate, well, what's the harm? If you didn't do anything wrong, you have nothing to hide. That is probably the most difficult argument to make, because most of us have been educated in schools owned by the government. Most of us have been taught from day one to show unique, unusual, and in my view, perverse subservience to the government. Most of us believe that the government is usually right. Now, I take the opposite view on all of those. The government is almost always wrong in almost everything that it does. The government does not create our rights. Only God has created our rights. The government cannot take those rights away from us. We can only surrender those rights by our own behavior when we violate the natural rights of others. That's the message of the book, what I just said in that past soliloquy. It's a tough sell with respect to privacy, and it's a tough sell with those who think that the government, that the state, is greater than individuals. But for people who understand the natural law, who believe that human beings are created in the image and likeness of God and have an immortal soul, and the government is just a temporary human organization based on force, this book is red meat, and they love it.
Judge, we've got just about 2 minutes, if that, but so it's totally unfair of me to ask you this question. But toward the end, when you're talking about taxation, you take a very radical position here that is that you can find in this book, that's basically arguing that taxation, because it involves coercion, it's an expropriation of peaceful people, is illegitimate. Are you willing to take that position? Am I understanding you correctly?
Well, I do take that position in the book. Now, of course, I'm not running for public office. I'm not running as somebody who wants to fund the government, but a government that I would fund would do far, far fewer things than what the present government does. It would resemble the federal government, absent things like slavery and suppression of women's rights that the founders gave us. There wouldn't be that we wouldn't need money for the Department of Education or the Department of Commerce or the Department of Agriculture or the Department of Health and Human Services or Housing and Urban Development. The government would stay within the confines of the Constitution, and it would be financed by user fees. Some of those fees would come from the states when the government, federal government, provided service to the states. Some would come from people using the government's ports and transporting goods through them. But look, you wouldn't let a crook steal money from you if he promised to give it away in your name. You wouldn't let your neighbors take money against your will if they promised to give it away in your name. Why would you let the government take your money against your will if they promise to give it away in your name? I don't see any difference.
No, it's nuggets like this that make this book so enjoyable. The book is It Is Dangerous to Be Right When the Government Is Wrong. My guest has been Judge Andrew Napolitano. Judge, what a pleasure to have you on. Thanks so much for taking some time today.
Thank you, my friend.
All right, everybody, stick around for another hour of the Peter Schiff Show. Oh, we got more controversial things to say. You're not going to want to miss it. Peter Schiff Show, the gold standard in talk radio.
Everything's gonna be all right. All right, all right. So long, old friend. When will we meet?
The Peter Schiff Show.
Make no friends in the pits and you take no prisoners. One minute you're up $500,000 in soybeans and the next, boom, your kids don't go to college and they've repossessed your Bentley. Are you with me?
The revolution starts now.
Starts.
We have to pass the bill so that you can find out what is in it.
Turn those machines back on!
You are about to enter the Peter Schiff Show.
Show me the money!
If we lose freedom here, there's no place to escape to. This is the last stand on earth.
The Peter Schiff Show is on.
Call in now. 855-4-SCHIFF.
That's 855-472-4433.
I don't know when they decided that they wanted to make a virtue out of selfishness.
Your money. Your stories.
Your freedom.
The Peter Schiff Show.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the Peter Schiff Show. I'm Tom Woods, in for Peter, here in the second hour on this Thursday. And we are joined by a man I've not met before, but whose book I have read and very much enjoyed. And that's Professor C. Bradley Thompson of Clemson University. Professor Thompson is a political science professor there. He's also executive director of the Clemson Institute for the Study of Capitalism. And the book we're going to be talking about today is Neoconservatism, an Obituary for an Idea. We hear the term neoconservative and neocon thrown around a lot. I think a lot of people don't know what it is or don't know much about it, or a lot of people are neocons without even knowing it. Just by default, they've become neocons. So this is an issue that couldn't be more significant, and I'm particularly grateful to Brad for joining us from the airport today. I know what that's like, being on the road and somehow you have to find a quiet corner where there's no groping going on so you can have a little bit of a time on the air. Brad Thompson, thanks so much for being with us today.
Hi, good morning. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. I want to let's just start right off just defining, if possible, briefly, when we say neoconservatism, and without talking about Leo Strauss, which we'll talk about later, what is it? What do these people believe?
Yeah, it's an important question. They will tell you that neoconservatism is not a political philosophy, that rather they call it an impulse, an orientation, a tendency, a persuasion, things like that. I've tried to argue in this book that neoconservatism is a comprehensive, consistent political philosophy. And in many ways, maybe the best way to define it is to use the definition by Daniel Bell, who was one of the leading neoconservatives, who describes himself as a socialist in economics, a liberal in politics, and a conservative in culture. And I think what that means is that neoconservatism is an amalgam of several competing philosophies, which is one of the reasons why it's I think always been so hard to define. More particularly, what I would say is that they are the advocates of what they call national greatness conservatism,
sends a shudder down my spine, that term.
And it should, because it is a rejection of what we might call Jeffersonian liberalism or Goldwater conservatism. They reject down the line the founding principles of the United States. They reject laissez-faire capitalism, limited government, and the idea of individual rights. And more particularly, the neoconservatives, they advocate government regulation of the economy and government regulation of our cultural life. So in a sense, they're the worst of the socialists and they're the worst of the conservatives, all rolled into one.
Now, I one of my classic, I think, neocon statements that I recall is from David Brooks in the New York Times, kind of scolding traditional conservatives who, you know, a traditional conservative is not a national greatness conservative. I mean, they believe in the greatness of America philosophically. But conservatives believe in finite goals and hearth and home. They don't believe in global crusades. That's revolutionary leftism. And yet a lot of Americans now, by default, have become revolutionary leftists and they think they're conservatives. But I love David Brooks saying, wanting to be left alone, which is precisely what Jeffersonianism and Goldwaterism was all about, isn't a governing doctrine. Yeah, that's what we like about it, David.
Exactly. And David Brooks is just following the godfather of neoconservatism, Irving Kristol, who once said that neoconservatism is the only conservatism that is, quote, in the American grain, which is to say that Goldwater conservatism or Jeffersonianism are outside the American grain. That is, the principles of capitalism, limited government, and individual rights, that is, the principles of the Declaration, are somehow outside the American grain, and only this national greatness conservatism is somehow in the American grain, which is to say that what the neoconservatives have done is to corrupt the very idea of what I have called traditional Goldwater conservatism, which I think really is just a kind of Jeffersonianism with the emphasis on limited government and individualism. And they categorically reject. I mean, one of the things that I try to do in this book is to show the way in which the neoconservatives actually reject the principles of the American founding, which, and what's odd about that is they will tell you publicly that they are great fans of the American founding. But philosophically speaking, they reject those principles. More importantly, they reject those principles, the idea of individualism or rugged individualism, because they say ultimately it leads to a kind of nihilism.
Right.
The nihilism that you get from modern 20th century European philosophers, which I think is wrong as a fact and disingenuous on their part. I think they know better, but they want to argue that Jeffersonian individualism leads to the nihilism of the new left. That is, Jeffersonian or the ideas of Thomas Jefferson lead to the ideas of Abby Hoffman and the new left of
right.
the 1960s. And that is just simply false.
It's a libel on the human race. I mean, really, to say that if we don't have them paternally exercising their custodianship over all of us, then we're just going to be a bunch of atomized individuals who don't care about anybody. Like, we wouldn't have families or civic groups or whatever if they weren't there to cultivate them. It's a very disturbing elitist kind of thing. Now, I thought I knew the neocons pretty well. The book, by the way, is Neoconservatism, an Obituary for an Idea. My guest is the author Bradley Thompson. But here you've really, in addition to your great analysis of what their philosophical presuppositions are, you've got some damaging quotations here. I mean, Irving Kristol, I think a lot of us know he supported the welfare state. He gives his famous two cheers for capitalism. But his son Bill and his magazine, The Weekly Standard, you've got Bill Kristol in here just coming right out and saying, we don't really want to shrink government. We just want to turn it to our ends. This is the great movement that right of center people, truck drivers, regular Americans are supposed to get on board for?
Precisely. I mean, you will note, for instance, that there is no neoconservative political party. There is no neoconservative Joe Sixpack. Neoconservatism is not a political movement. It's an intellectual philosophic movement that does try to influence public policy, but from the top down.
Right.
And they have, over the course of the last 25 years, they have come to completely dominate the conservative and even some of the libertarian think tanks and philanthropic foundations, certainly in the media, magazines like you mentioned, The Weekly Standard, and even Fox News. The larger conservative intellectual movement has been essentially taken over by the neoconservatives and corrupted by them.
Well, we've got much more to talk about here. Can this grip ever be removed? We have much more to say. I just love this book, really. Neoconservatism, an Obituary for an Idea. We've got another segment coming up with Bradley Thompson. Make sure and stick around here on The Peter Schiff Show, the gold standard in talk radio.
I feel depressed, I feel so bad.
The Peter Schiff Show. Since the Peter Schiff Show was last on the air, the national debt added another $7.89 million. Luckily, Peter's intelligence is growing twice as fast.
That's incredible.
Welcome back to your source of sanity in an insane world. It's the Peter Schiff Show.
And we are back on the Peter Schiff Show. I'm Tom Woods in for Peter. Joined by Bradley Thompson, author of Neoconservatism, an Obituary for an Idea. Now, Brad, you and I have a different kind of a critique of the neocons' foreign policy, but what we share in common is we're not convinced about this imperative to spread so-called democracy around the world as if this were some conservative imperative, when it seems to me this is exactly the sort of thing Edmund Burke would have rolled his eyes at and said, well, this is what a leftist does, going around trying to uproot traditional societies and remake them like Tinker Toys. Like, no conservative would think that was doable or desirable. Can you elaborate on the neocons' foreign policy?
Sure. Yeah, I think you're right. Both Edmund Burke, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams would have all rejected the neoconservatives' foreign policy. The neocons call their foreign policy benevolent hegemony. And the idea here is that we'll spread our love and our power around the world. So we'll drop bombs and we'll drop food packages all at the same time. This is absolutely a rejection of the Founding Fathers' foreign policy. But what's, I think, most important to say about their foreign policy is that, in fact, it is a branch of their domestic policy. So for the last 10 years, the left have been arguing against, and partly rightly so, against the neocons' foreign policy, but for all the wrong reasons. They don't understand it at all. The neocons' foreign policy its purpose is twofold. First, I mean, the real enemy for America, for the neocons, is not communism. It's not radical Islam. It's the philosophy of nihilism. They argue that the American people have become morally corrupt, bankrupt, heathenish, and therefore, in order to overcome this nihilism, we have to sacrifice ordinary, everyday Americans in military adventures around the world. They want to put America on a state of permanent warfare, the purpose of which is actually twofold. One, as I said, to make ordinary, everyday Americans more virtuous, to get them to focus their lives in sacrificing for the nation state. And secondly, it's also a vehicle by which neoconservative statesmen can exercise their philosophic and political virtue, their statesman-like virtues, on a large worldwide platform.
Well, it's interesting that you make that connection between the domestic and the foreign policy, because one of the quotations in your book that really struck me is from Max Boot, who is, you know, who's written on quite a bit on warfare. He's with the Council on Foreign Relations. He's been a critic of mine in the past. I wear that as a medal on my chest. But to read Max Boot, he right here in your book, he says, "Why not use some of the awesome power of the U.S. government to help the downtrodden of the world, just as it is used to help the needy at home?" Well, who is this, Lyndon Johnson? And these are the people Americans are supposed to follow?
Yeah, exactly. So, in other words, ordinary, everyday Americans, red state Americans, are going to sacrifice their lives, their fortunes and their sacred honor to spread the American welfare state to Iraq. It's a deeply and profoundly immoral policy. Also consider, for instance, this statement from Robert Kagan, who is also one of the leading neocons on foreign policy. He said, quote, "The remoralization of America at home ultimately requires the remoralization of American foreign policy." Right? So the idea is, I mean, the end goal is to remoralize the American people. Therefore, we're going to send our military all over the world in order to moralize or remoralize the American people at home.
Now, Brad, I've got two really big questions I want to ask you, and only about 5 minutes in which to ask them. So we'll try and keep it as punchy as possible. Then I'd love to, if I have another chance, to have you back. It would be just great. But two things. One, you know, you talk about the philosopher Leo Strauss and his influence on the neocons. What I'll just say here is that Strauss did seem to believe that there was a qualitative difference between the sort of the philosopher king and the great run of mankind, and the great run of mankind can't really be brought on to our program, honestly, so we have to kind of snooker them into it. You know, we got to sell it to them as a kind of religious imperative. We got to exploit their religious belief, turn it into some type of civic religion where the U.S. flag is like almost like the cross, and people can't even distinguish them, and it becomes like a holy cause. Whatever we need to do to dupe the rubes into supporting our global program, we'll do. But yet, somebody like Sean Hannity, I just frankly don't think is bright enough to be reading Leo Strauss. So how come all these radio hosts, why are they all neocons? Like, how did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long process. Ideas have consequences. And the neocons took over. I mean, they are really the only conservative presence on American college campuses, and there are some absolutely first-rate neoconservative intellectuals. They have a strong foothold in the universities, and with that, then they just simply took over the conservative foundations and philanthropic foundations. And so over time, their ideas have spread down and through the larger or broader conservative culture. And so, you know, I mean, magazines like the National Review, Weekly Standard, for instance, they're all infused by neoconservatism. And so, you know, eventually these ideas trickle down into the heads of people like Sean Hannity.
Now, given precisely what you've just said, that the neocons have just they dominate, and once they dominate something, they tend to impose a very strict ideological litmus test. So when the neocons took over the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal some years ago, a lot of my friends just couldn't get published anymore, even though my friends are totally free, much more free market than the neocons are. Maybe that's why they couldn't get published. But they enforce this with the same vigor that any leftist on a faculty committee at a university would enforce ideological conformity there. So my question to you is, now, your book is called Neoconservatism, an Obituary for an Idea. That's, of course, a play on Irving Kristol's essay, Socialism, an Obituary for an Idea. When he wrote that, socialism was not about to die, but it was a dead ideology walking, and all the, you know, eventually it was going to die. Well, do you see this coming? Is there any way, other than the complete bankruptcy of the country, which might discredit the neocons, so that we could get something other than neoconservatism that's right of center? And by the way, we've only got about 2 minutes to answer that question. Good luck.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think the single most important thing is, first, we have to identify precisely what the neoconservative ideology is, which the book attempts to do. And it's, I believe it's the first book to really expose neoconservatism as a comprehensive political philosophy. And then secondly, more importantly, the advocates of individual rights, limited government, and laissez-faire capitalism have to be uncompromising advocates of those principles. And at every opportunity, they have to call out the neoconservatives on these very principles. So, I mean, for instance, as you suggested earlier, and as I write in the book, Irving Kristol only gave two cheers for capitalism. Why only two cheers? Well, he withheld the last cheer because, in the end, he thought capitalism is simply, as do all Marxists, he thinks it's simply immoral. It doesn't have a moral foundation. So the primary task, I think, for the defenders of capitalism and limited government is we need to do a much better job of identifying and defining the moral foundations of a free society, which, unfortunately, I don't think the advocates of those broader principles have done.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more there. My guest has been Bradley Thompson, author of Neoconservatism, an Obituary for an Idea. And I agree with you, Brad, that this book, I haven't seen anyone, you know, you see these vignettes of individual neoconservatives, but I have not seen an attempt to really draw out what Leo Strauss was saying into really the full-fledged political philosophy that the neocons hold. And one of the things they do to try to get you off the track is to pretend neoconservatism doesn't exist, or we just made it up, or whatever. It exists. It's damaging our country. It's snookering a lot of otherwise decent people into thinking, well, I'm not Hillary Clinton, so I must be a neocon. There's another option. It's called Americanism and Jeffersonianism. Brad Thompson, thanks so much for being my guest today on The Peter Schiff Show.
Tom, thank you so much.
All right, everybody, stick around for more of The Peter Schiff Show, the gold standard in talk radio. Make sure and call in 855-472-4433. That's 855-4-SHIP.
The Peter Schiff Show.
Now return to the Peter Schiff Show.
Call in now, 855-4-SCHIFF.
That's 855-472-4433.
Rebel Radio, the Peter Schiff Show.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Peter Schiff Show. I'm Tom Woods in for Peter. About to go to the phones. I do want to just note before that I'll be speaking in Houston tomorrow at the Street Talk Advisors X Factor Investment Conference. And also in Jacksonville, Florida, October 22nd, as part of the great Nullify Now tour, Nullify Now Jacksonville. Details on those and other events are available at my website, tomwoods.com. Okay, let's go to the phones, and I thank everybody for your patience. I during with the guests on, it's hard to get to the phones, but Let's go to Bob in Boulder, Colorado. Bob, welcome to the Peter Schiff Show.
Yeah, hi, Tom. You know, for a long time, I've been following your discussion of the idea of nullification, and very interested in that. But I've also got something else I wanted to ask you specifically. It kind of goes along the same lines, going into the Constitution, and that is, looking at Article 5, there are basically two ways to get amendments. One is the traditional route through Congress. The other one is very clearly to me on petition of the states, two-thirds of the states, for something that they're referring to in the document as an amendments convention. Now, this is not a constitutional convention. Usually when you bring this up, people roll their eyes or they flip out.
Right.
They're thinking you're advocating a general, constitutional convention. Can you tell me a little bit about your interpretation of Article 5 and what an amendments convention would look like?
Sure. You're right that the Constitution identifies two ways that you'd go about amending the Constitution. One is that the Congress approves an amendment and then sends it out to the states for ratification. But the other process is where the states do a complete end run around Congress and call a convention of their own to propose amendments. And that, that's never been used, but the idea of it was that what if Congress is the problem? Which of course it is in our own day. Congress is the problem. What's the likelihood that the solution is going to come from Congress? What's the likelihood they're going to submit amendments that might actually have some good effect? And so that's why the amendments convention exists as an option. Now, there are some people who say, well, look, you can amend the Constitution all you want, but if they're not obeying the Constitution as it exists now, why would they obey any of your amendments? And to some extent, that's a valid concern. But and I say this as somebody who I'm way past the Constitution at this point. I just feel like the whole thing is beyond repair. But you could make it less corrupt and less ineffective and horrendous than it is through some structural amendments. Like, what if there were amendments that expressly codified some type of ability of the states to resist on a corporate level what the federal government is doing? Then I think you would see federal laws actually getting repealed. Like, I mean, a nullification says a state could just not enforce a federal law. But what if you had an amendment that said, if X number of states vote to repeal, not just not enforce it in their states, but repeal for the whole country a federal law, then it would be repealed. That would be a structural change that I think would be better than what we have now. And what are the chances that Congress is going to introduce an amendment that's going to challenge its power in that way? And that's why people are talking about an Article 5 convention. Now, you're right. The concern about the Article 5 convention is that it becomes a runaway convention, that before you know it, they're going to impose the Communist Manifesto on us, and then we'll be stuck with it. Now, I wouldn't say I'm rah-rah for an Article 5 convention. I mean, I do think there are some legitimate concerns about it, but I'm not – and each state would decide on its own basis who would be sent to be delegates, in effect, at a convention like that. It would be up to each state to decide – on what basis it would make that determination. That's what it would look like. But what would actually ensue at a convention like this? Well, I guess I'm not as concerned about it as I once was, and basically for this reason. I used to be scared away from this on the grounds that, well, think about what would happen if we had a constitutional convention. And my response is, well, gee, what could it lead to? Would it lead to a Congress that can just legislate in any area it wants to? Would it lead to a president who can just commence military operations anywhere he wants to at any time? Would it lead to in other words, would it lead to exactly what we already have? I mean, in other words, all the nightmare scenarios that are presented to us typically are describing the situation we are already in. And so I don't any longer fear quite so much what they would do to us that isn't already an existing thing. So that's how I sort of feel about it. I'm kind of on the fence, but I'm not as terrified about it as I once was. I don't think it's likely to happen, but I wouldn't just dismiss it on the grounds that, well, it'll lead to Hillary's manifesto being imposed on all of us, because 3/4 of the states would have to then ratify these amendments. That's what amendments have to be ratified constitutionally. These two things are just simply ways that you bring about amendments, but amendments are explained in the Constitution how it is that they are to be approved and you're not going to get three quarters of the country approving the Communist Manifesto. If they do, then you got to get out, right? I mean, then at that point, convention or no convention, you just got to get the heck out of here, would be my suggestion to you. All right, Bob, thanks for the call. I'm going to go now to Alex in Brooklyn, who wins the prize for most patient caller in the history of the Peter Schiff Show. Alex, congratulations. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks. I made an observation about deflation in the dollar, and I'm wondering if you can just tell me if I'm wrong on this.
But, okay, it might be more of a Peter question, but I'll do my best.
Sure. It seems like everybody's saying that if we have deflation, the dollar is going to get really strong. But it seems like to me, if we started having major deflation and there was bankruptcies and everything started kind of collapsing, the government would be collecting a lot less tax revenue. So then they couldn't really pay off their bonds. So once that happens, wouldn't people lose a lot of faith in the dollar? And then if that's the case, wouldn't people probably stop using the dollar as a reserve currency? And if a currency is backed by a country's own production, the U.S. doesn't really produce anything. So how could the dollar stay strong in a deflationary environment if that's the case?
Okay, it's a good question. I mean, I'll try and answer it this way. I don't think there – and thank you very much for the call and again for your patience. I would answer it sort of this way. I don't think that if we're defining deflation, as I think you are, as a general fall in prices, not as a fall in the actual money supply, which we're not really that likely to see, but – if we define it as a fall in prices, I don't think it has to lead to a general downturn. It could lead to a lot of bankruptcies in the sense that a lot of business firms who, let's say, didn't anticipate the deflation when they produced their products, and then their products go for sale on the market, and they can't fetch the selling prices that these businesses were anticipating when they put all these materials in, they laid out all these costs. Yeah, that's going to hurt those businesses if they didn't anticipate the deflation. If they did anticipate it, if the deflation is anticipated, if the market expects deflation, then that's already going to be reflected in the input prices of the stuff the businesses buy. So if, you know, I'm a I don't know, whatever. I mean, I make widgets. All the inputs that I need for widgets will already have factored into them the fact that I know I won't be able to make the same profit on widgets nominally as I used to because prices are going to be lower. So the input prices are going to be bid down. And so therefore, I will still be able to maintain my profit spread between costs and sales revenues because the input prices will already have adjusted to anticipate the future deflation. So that doesn't have to lead to problems. But suppose, take the hard case, suppose the business firms fail to anticipate the deflation. They don't see the lower prices coming, and then they bring their products to market, and they can't sell them at a rate that's at a price that's going to give them a profit, and they go bankrupt. All right, but the bankruptcy then is followed by reorganization and new owners now get that capital for a song, for just for pennies on the dollar at auction, and then they can start off very robustly with very low cost, so they will be very competitive at those lower prices. So I don't think it has to lead to a general collapse. I think, in fact, falling prices can indeed typically is a very healthy thing for the economy. We've got just a couple minutes before we got to go to our last break of the program. So before we do that, I want to make a plug for something that I've mentioned in the past, but that I think listeners of this program are really going to love and really want to get behind. And that is the great economist Robert Murphy. You see him a lot on the Judge's program. We talked to the judge in the last hour, and he is a semi-frequent guest here on the Peter Schiff Show. Robert Murphy is an NYU economics PhD who has an outstanding invitation to Paul Krugman, the guy who drives you crazy every week in the New York Times, to debate him about business cycles, what causes the economy to go up and down. And of course, Bob wants to talk about the Federal Reserve as being the culprit. And now you say, okay, whoop-de-doo, everybody wants to debate Paul Krugman. What does this matter, right? What's going to happen here? This is never going to come to pass. But what Bob has done is he has used the Point website, which basically allows you to do something like this, that Bob solicits pledges. You pledge money, your credit card is not charged until the debate occurs. So if the debate never occurs, you know, you could pledge $1 million. Make sure you're prepared in case it does occur to make good on $1 million. But the point is that you don't actually get charged until the debate occurs. And when the debate occurs, all that money isn't going to go to Krugman, isn't going to go to Murphy. It's going to go to a home that feeds the hungry in New York City. So it's a brilliant strategy. So if Bob gets up to like $100,000, you're like, what are Krugman supporters going to say? Like, you can't even spare 1 hour to debate Murphy? if it would mean $100,000 going to hungry people. And when Bob hits $100,000, I mean, I think the best thing to do would have that home for the hungry issue a press release appealing to Krugman. For heaven's sake, man, what possible harm could it do to debate this guy on business cycle theory? So it's a brilliant plan. So Bob is already at $70,000 pledged. It's incredible. I mean, this is a PR stroke of brilliance because it's lose-lose for Krugman. Either he's an ogre who doesn't care about the hungry, or he loses a debate with Bob Murphy, and we get to see an Austrian free market economist debate a Keynesian economist. Check out KrugmanDebate.com. That's K-R-U-G-M-A-N, KrugmanDebate.com. And let's get that pledge number up there. All right, everybody, we're going to be coming back after the break with one final segment. I'll be taking more of your calls at 855-472-4433. That's 855-4-SCHIFF. It's Peter Schiff Show, the gold standard in talk radio. Stick around.
The Peter Schiff Show.
To President Obama, Secretary Geithner, Madam Pelosi, and all of the socialist econ professors across America.
We're sorry.
We're sorry.
Peter Schiff is back on the air.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Peter Schiff Show. I'm Tom Woods, in for Peter. It's our final segment. These 2 hours just fly right by. Let's go to the phones. I'm going to talk to Sean in Lincoln, Illinois. Sean, thanks for your patience, and welcome to the Peter Schiff Show.
Thanks, Tom. Good talking to you. I want to thank you for the work you've done on Ron Paul's Super PAC. This latest news with Iran and terror, that seems to be the knock when I'm in conversations with other Republicans or conservatives is, you know, crazy Uncle Ron wants Iran to have the nuke and his foreign policy's kooky. I think the latest commercial with, you know, what if foreign countries were on our soil out of the Super PAC is a good talking point to that. But how else do we combat this knock on Ron Paul's foreign policy, particularly with the warmongering that seems to be going on related to Iran?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, if there are a lot of different things we could say. There's a good article today in the and first of all, thanks for the call and thanks for your patience. The Christian Science Monitor has a very good article today called "Hey America, Iran Still Isn't Threat Number One," that gives a more sober look at the real leadership in Tehran, which is not Ahmadinejad, by the way, who has relatively little power in the grand scheme of things. And they go down, and this article goes through and explains that, you know, you've got, this is a country that ranks 61st in the world in military expenditures. It's 104th in terms of GDP per capita. That this is another example of a threat being ramped up by people who consistently lie to us, right? I mean, I can't believe that the Iraq thing was just an honest mistake by well-meaning people. I mean, these are people who had their Middle Eastern ambitions long before 9/11, and that was just a pretext to execute them. But, I mean, I think Ron Paul's point is that the country is broke, that Iran would be completely obliterated by Israel and possibly even the U.S. If it were to launch a nuclear missile that it doesn't have with a delivery system that it doesn't have on American soil. This is a country that has not launched an offensive war in as long as anybody can remember, and the leadership in Iran, as I say, is not it's oddball. But it's not suicidal. I mean, anybody who studies it closely will, and not just reads the New York Times, will more or less tell you that. But I would say that basically what this would lead to, what an invasion of Iran, which is what would be necessary, would lead to, would just be right off the bat $10 a gallon gasoline. I mean, that's just absolute guarantee. And then this is just going to persist year after year after year. I mean, you think Iraq was difficult to subdue. Iran is much more substantial, much greater size. Iran has been empowered by the Iraq invasion, of course, as any bonehead could have known. You take out a Sunni regime that's hostile to Iran, and you let the Shiites get more power. I mean, hello? you wonder, are these people really being serious with me, that they care so much about the Islamic threat? These are the same neocons that in the 1990s pushed to have an Islamic state in the heart of Europe, in Bosnia. They pushed for that. They were the ones who pushed for bombing Serbia over the issue of Kosovo, the civil war that was going on there. These are the people who – I mean, you can't take these people seriously. They're all over the map. All they care about is bombing. It doesn't matter if there's any coherence to the bombing. What they want is just an enormous amount of expenditure, and it's coming to an end. This could well provoke the fiscal crisis that just puts the country over the edge. It can't work, apart from the fact that huge numbers of innocent people – and most Iranians are pretty normal people. If you've seen any footage of them, they're basically just regular people just trying to lead their lives. And this would lead to countless deaths. It would lead to – who knows the regional explosions that could result, the destabilization of Pakistan, where you really do have an existing, not just an imaginary, but an existing nuclear power. The unintended consequences of this are so potentially explosive. And yet the conservatives, who they'll see the unintended consequences of a milk subsidy, but they don't see the unintended consequence of a war with Iran at a time when regimes across the region are being toppled and replaced with much more Islamic-friendly and anti-American regimes. You think that's going to throttle that, or you think it's going to encourage it further? Every negative trend that is existing right now in the Middle East will be ramped up by 10 times. So right now, as I say, I would check out, because I almost read it on the air and I realize I won't have time. I would check out this article in the Christian Science Monitor, "Hey America, Iran Still Isn't Threat Number One." And then secondly, I would look for videos and articles by Michael Scheuer, S-C-H-E-U-E-R, who was once the head of the CIA's Bin Laden unit. He's not naive. He does not, by the way, hold a rosy view of Islam. Scheuer believes Islam to be a backward and very illiberal religion. He is not saying that Islam is full of peace and they just want to throw flowers at us. He does not take that view. He said, but nevertheless, the foreign policy that the U.S. government is pursuing is bad for us. It's bad for everybody. And so check him out. His blog is, I think, called Non-Intervention. So if you type in Non-Intervention and Michael Scheuer, I think you'll get some pretty good resources. But the bottom line is, as of now, when you add in all the different expenses that are associated with the military, it's not just the Pentagon budget, but it's the portion of the Department of Energy that's defense-related. It's the Department of Homeland Security. I mean, what is that if not defense? It's the Department of Veterans Affairs. It's the portion of the national debt, the interest payments on the national debt that's due to previous military strength. Previous military expenditures. This is adding up to about $1 trillion a year. That's plus the appropriations for the existing wars. That's $1 trillion a year. Where is this going to come from? And that's assuming that the U.S. can keep borrowing at very, very low rates. Do we want to bring on the great fiscal collapse if there is any chance at all of averting it? Have all options been exhausted? Have they even been tried? That would be the kind of question I would want to know. Where's the money going to come from in this sort of situation? Well, I can take now. Gosh, we are so close to the end. Yeah, I would, Robert. I'd love to get to you and talk about this subject, but we'll have to perhaps wait till next time. We are very much coming up toward the end of our time together. But I, as I say, I strongly recommend Scheuer and also Phil Giraldi, G-I-R-A-L-D-I. Look for his writing on the internet, Phil Giraldi and Scheuer, and also look for ammunition at antiwar.com, which has some left-leaning people writing on it, but is a lot of conservatives and libertarians who are sick and tired of the bankrupting foreign policy. Definitely check out antiwar.com. And when they accuse you of being a leftist because you read articles by leftists, well, look, Hillary Clinton supported the Iraq War. John Kerry supported the Iraq War. Howard Stern supported the Iraq War. You know, before they accuse you of having strange bedfellows, they better wipe themselves off first. All right. My thanks to my guest, Judge Andrew Napolitano and Professor C. Bradley Thompson. Thanks so much to the callers and particularly those I didn't get to. My apologies. And thanks to all you guys on the staff here. Help me through these 2 hours. It was a pleasure. Peter will rejoin you tomorrow, I believe. And thanks so much for joining us on The Peter Schiff Show, the gold standard in talk radio. Check me out at tomwoods.com, and thanks a lot. No matter who you are.